Welcome to Books and Beer. I am your host, Michael Malone. I'm here at the craft beer sanctuary known as The Oath in Tarrytown, New York, where the sun has finally come out after many, many days of rainy weather. And I'm here with Robert McMillan, author of one of the more unique book offerings of the past year or so. It is called Haiku 61 Revisited, The Songs of Bob Dylan Interpreted as Haiku. I will let that sink in for a moment there. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
How was your trip up here?
Trip was fantastic. I watched the Hudson River and the Palisades, and it was a nice, dreamy, and smooth train ride.
Good, good. Have you ever been to Tarrytown before?
I was in Tarrytown probably the last time maybe 10 years ago, and then the last time before that, I think I must have been 5 or 6 years old, so it's been a long time.
Okay.
To me, it's all Headless Horseman and Washington Irving.
We have some of that around here, very definitely, and the region makes the most of it around autumn every year. So, like I said in the intro, a very unique book. How did this come to be?
A great way to start a show, I'll say, is a little complicated,
okay.
but I'll do the short version. I work for the Reuters News Service, and back in 2009, I think it was, maybe it was the end of 2008, I don't quite remember, we used to use some people will be familiar with this, we used to use a DOS-based publishing system to publish our stories. And it also came with a little area at the top of the screen where you could write messages to individuals elsewhere in Reuters, or you could write to groups of people. And we called these screen tops because they were located at the top of the screen.
Okay.
Now, screen tops were, in a way, an antecedent of something like Twitter, in that we were restricted to a certain character count, or else it would you'd run out of space. And we would use this service to talk between bureaus and talk to different reporters and editors to point out stories maybe that our competitors had, or to note that maybe, since we were doing business news coverage, maybe a certain stock of a company of interest to us was suddenly rising 10%. And could we figure out why that was and maybe try to get a story out on that? And we used it for a variety of things. But when we would communicate these things, sometimes, what we wanted to say was too long to fit in the screen tops. And so what we would do, I remember one day in particular, we were messing around and there wasn't a whole lot of news going on. But we started outpointing, as we call it at Reuters. We started outpointing different stories to one another, but we wrote them as haikus, so we would be sure that they would fit in the space. And of course, as reporters with idle hands will do, we just started having a conversation about haiku and what you could use it for and what you couldn't use it for. And
yeah.
Eventually we started saying, what about rock and roll lyrics? We can sum up a song as a haiku. And I wish I could remember what some of them were. I think we did Rhiannon by Fleetwood Mac at one point. Or something like, ooh, I'm a sexy witch and I'm going to tempt you with my long golden hair or something. I don't remember quite what the haiku was, but one of my colleagues, a guy named Derek Caney, he said, well, I bet you couldn't do that with Bob Dylan. And I said, why not? He says, because a lot of the songs are they're erudite, first of all. Some of them couch themselves in a great deal of willful obscurity. There's a lot of, as most people know, a lot of symbolism and surreal imagery that Dylan brings to his work. And it might be too much to boil it on down. And without really thinking, I typed out the words, Bob knows so little, he asks where the answers are, he has a strong hunch. And my friend wrote back and he said, that's blowing in the wind. And I said, you're absolutely right, that's correct.
Wow.
And I just started trying to flip a few more in his direction. Then I went with Lay Lady Lay from the Nashville Skyline album from 1969. And I said, the song goes, Lay Lady Lay, lay across your big brass bed. How long to see you in the morning, and whatever else he sings, but obviously it's a seduction song.
Yeah.
And why wait any longer for the one you love when he's standing in front of you? I said, he's asking her to lay on his brass bed. which is a pretty ballsy thing to do. So I said, you know, Bob wants you in bed. He has balls and beds of brass. You're lying on them. I said, all right, hit me with another one. And we kept doing this. Now, at the time, my girlfriend, who is now my wife, she worked for Reuters as well, but she had recently been posted to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And we were conducting a long-distance relationship. Now, I was enjoying the haiku process so much that when I went home that night, and I was home alone most nights because I was alone in my home in Jersey City, mm-hmm. I didn't have a whole lot to do, read books, clean the house, do the dishes, this kind of thing. And I started writing a few more haiku down. And I thought, you know, I'm having so much fun doing this that I think I'm just going to tackle them all. What the hell? You know?
Them all.
Just for fun. I just said, I'll take all his albums and I'll go through them and see what I can do.
Okay.
You know, because even back then in 2008 or whatever it was, he already had a prodigious catalog, but still not quite as much as this intervening decade has now produced a bunch more archive albums, new albums, all this kind of stuff. So I did, I don't know, maybe about 400 or 500 songs, and it didn't take long. I was knocking them out one by one. It was like eating popcorn. And another friend of mine who also worked at Reuters said, who covered big media conglomerates, he said, you know, I have some friends at Sony, you should talk to them. Because Sony, of course, is the label that owns Columbia, which puts out Dylan's albums.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, you should do a book. You know, it would be a funny book. And I said, nobody would buy this book. He said, well, what the hell? Why don't you give it a try anyway? And I said, would you buy the book? He says, I don't like Dylan. Mm. I said, okay, but presumably somebody might, and maybe somebody would buy it. And so I did. I wrote a book and basically put together a ton of these haiku. And, you know, I didn't write any supplemental material about them. I just did the poems. And then I went out, I was at a bachelor party, in fact, where I ran into a guy who was a published author, and the idea tickled him, and he said, well, I know an agent you should talk to, and he set me up, and in fact, I got representation from a big-time agent who handled big-time publishers, and we went out, and we did our best to sell this book, and we bombed.
Okay.
Nobody bought it. So I was somewhat disappointed, although not entirely surprised.
Right.
I put it aside and didn't really think about it for at least 2 years. And then one day I thought, I'm sitting on potentially good material here. It could be better. I need to rewrite it. I need to rethink what the concept of the book is. But damn it, I can't have spent all that time for no reason.
Right.
I'm going to publish this, and if I can't find a publisher, then you know, by God, I'm going to put it out myself.
Sure.
Right? And what the hell? At least I'll have written a book.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was the genesis up through the most of the five books of the Torah about how it got ready for publication.
So how many total haiku in the book then? About 700?
It is nearly 700.
Okay.
I know it's in the high 600s somewhere, but I haven't counted in a while. I think about 670 haiku is about right.
Okay. All right. But why don't you read a couple instead of talking about them, how about showing us some of your
haiku skills? Sure, I can do
that. Skills.
I picked a bunch here for one reason or another. Now, I have some essays that go along with these. Some of them are pretty short. If they're short enough, I'll shoehorn them in here. But, one song I think that some people have heard by Dylan is a song from the John Wesley Harding album, and it's called The Wicked Messenger.
Mm.
And for that one, I said, man learns a lesson. They do shoot the messenger. He gets a new job. And of course, the story behind the wicked messenger, very briefly, is that there's a guy, Dylan says there was a wicked messenger from Eli. He did come. He didn't speak. He only answered with his thumb. His tongue, it couldn't speak. It could only flatter. And when people sent for him and questioned where he'd come from, he wouldn't speak. But of course, that's all metaphor. When he did speak, he pissed the people off. He only told them bad news, right?
Okay.
And there's a wonderful moment that's almost religious, where he has a moment of enlightenment, where as Dylan says, the people that confronted him were many, and it was these few words which opened up his heart. They said, "If you cannot bring good news, then don't bring any." And it's a really cryptic song. You know, kind of couched in a lot of Old Testament imagery and all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that's where I drew the lines for that particular for that particular haiku.
Okay.
That's another one that that I thought was worth sharing. you know, there's a period where Dylan went through a born-again Christian phase, and it reflected in his albums that came out between 79 and 81.
Yeah.
And on one of them, you know, this album called Saved, where he really went for a gospel sound. I did one called Covenant Woman. Man with covenant seeks single woman with same. Christians only, please. I tried to make it like the Pina Colada song of singles ads, right? Because as Dylan points out, she's got a contract with God, and she has a big reward coming in heaven.
Yeah.
And he's going to stick with her, especially for praying to God on Bob's behalf. God, of course, is going to do all sorts of things, but mainly he's going to make sure that he gets to stick with this gal because she's not only a covenant woman, but she's apparently fairly attractive.
Yeah. How about like a Rolling Stone? It's the one everybody knows.
Yeah, absolutely.
You better have a good one for that.
I've dog-eared that one, and that one I went with a thing that haiku never does. They don't rhyme in Japanese or English.
Okay.
But you know what? I don't feel like poetry should be its rules should necessarily be buried in amber.
Right.
Right. So this one I went with a rhyme. Like a Rolling Stone, now you feel like a stone alone. Without a home, because of your tone.
Huh. It almost feels like the song. Actually.
It almost, this one, I had to work on that a few times. But, you know, that was one of those ones where it's very clear what he's singing about. That this is the downfall of most likely a woman who he clearly has had the hots for, in my opinion, at some point.
Yeah.
Right? But she treated him like garbage. And now she's going through tough times, and he's taunting her. Right,
yeah.
Which is a recurring feature in a lot of Dylan's work.
Yeah, Positively 4th Street comes to mind. Certainly.
Absolutely, and Positively 4th Street, for instance, which I know I have it buried somewhere in here. Gosh, where did I put that one? It was released, of course, as a single, and I included it as a single, so it's not in one of the album lineups. I know I have it here somewhere. Positively 4th Street, rage, jealousy, scorn. Negatively 4th Street is where this guy must live. You know. So, I see if I can pick out...
Well, a question for you. How do you balance... they're funny, they're clever, they're witty, and you want to be respectful, because presumably you're a Dylan fan as well. So how do you kind of strike that balance between being funny and being respectful in the haiku?
So, broadly, I tried to go with the tone of the song. If the song is so earnest in its sadness... I didn't want to mess around with it by making a mockery of it,
okay.
Or making a farce out of it. And one example, there's a song called Forgetful Heart. And it's on an album called Together Through Life from 2009.
It almost
plays like a dirge. And it's, you know, Forgetful Heart. He's lamenting at this heart of his that has suffered through so much damage from his life trying to, fall in love.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, the haiku in that one, I tried to make it witty without being... funny. And I said, when the heart forgets how it used to love, the mind is doomed to recall.
Hmm.
Right? So that's, you know, I tried to match it up with the tone a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? On the other hand, Dylan's done a lot of songs that are, there are some of his where he got so serious where I thought he was verging into maudlin, and this happened more with a lot of his very early work.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm allowed to use a cuss word.
You can say
on a podcast.
Whatever the F you want. Here.
So there's a song called Percy's Song, which is a kind of an unknown one from the archives that got resurrected on one of his bootleg series, I think, or maybe it was on Biograph, which was a box set in the 80s that had a lot of rarities on it.
Okay.
Percy's Song is one of these almost Elizabethan ballad type of songs where a guy goes to plead the case of his friend before a judge.
Mm-hmm.
The friend was involved in an accident, a car accident, in which I think three people were killed or four people were killed, and the judge has no mercy for Percy. He puts him behind bars, and he's going to go in 99 years, right? And so, and Dylan, as a result, bemoans the cruel state of the world, and as he says in the chorus, the cruel rain and the wind, right?
Yeah.
And for that one, I said, Bob implores the judge who sentenced his guilty friend. The judge says, tough shit. You know, I figured it with that one, I wasn't going over the line.
Right, no, that's fair. One request, you take requests?
I take requests.
Okay, how about Idiot Wind?
All right, Idiot Wind, I can, that's an easy one, and in fact, I had a feeling it might come up.
That seems like a juicy one.
It is, and you know what, I'm gonna take your request and I'm gonna match it with one of my own. Idiot Wind, from Blood on the Tracks, We had some good times, but I'd much rather focus on hating you now.
That's cold.
Because, you know, that's one of those ones where I don't think anything can quite get at the sheer heartbreak and rage that blow through that song, as he says, blowing like a sucker around my skull from the Grand Coulee Dam to the Capitol.
Yeah.
You know, and these lines about blowing through the curtains in your room. I mean, it's a song that I don't listen to that album very much anymore, because songs like that, actually, they tend to make me cry. I find them almost too hard to bear.
There's so much pain in that song.
But, you know, on that same album, there's a more dispassionate song where he tells the story of Lily and Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is a 9-minute, or almost 9-minute epic about a bank heist in a western saloon town, you know, and there's a
lots of characters getting
up to various things. Now, I had a really hard time with this one, but in the end, I thought, let's just keep it to the facts. Jack robs bank, Lily cuckolds Rosemary with Jim, Rose kills him, then hangs.
Oh, man, you got a lot to do.
I didn't get the hanging judge in there, I didn't get the priest, I didn't know who was, or the guy who was dressed as the, you know, in the costume of a monk, but I thought, that's the tweet.
Yes. Right,
if you were reporting that story.
Right. Nicely done. What was the hardest song to come up with a haiku for?
There were two songs, there were many songs that bedeviled me, but there were only two songs that absolutely really beat the crap out of me. And I have to say that the main one is Joker Man, which is one of my favorite Dylan songs.
Mm-hmm.
For folks who don't know Dylan so well and are interested in getting into him more, it's the opening song on an album from 1983, and the album's called Infidels. And it's many songs that deal with the Middle East. And Israel's, it's a very pro-Jewish album in many ways. And then he does the whole thing with Mark Knopfler from Dire Straits on guitar, and then Sly and Robbie from Jamaica doing a kind of almost reggae-ish drum and bass section behind him. But Joker Man has this smooth, beautiful sound. It's stuffed with images that may or may not relate to each other. And generally speaking, I didn't really know what to do with it. So I wrote, man of influence and power doesn't know how to fix the world. And that's, you know, I haven't done it justice. And, you know, because he's got all this stuff. He's got the Molotovs, cocktails and rocks behind every curtain. He's got distant ships sailing into the mist. You were born with a snake in both your fists while a hurricane was blowing. But, and then he has this whole thing about where he might be singing about Jesus as a Messiah, but he might also be singing about the Antichrist trying to influence the souls of society all at once. And you really don't know in the end, because he ends with this beautiful line that I couldn't possibly work into the haiku, where he says he's put the priests in his pocket, put the plane to the heat, and took the motherless children off the street and placed them at the feet of a harlot. And then it ends with, oh, Joker Man, you know what he wants. Oh, Joker Man, you don't show any response. I'm thinking, like, what is he going on about?
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
It shimmers with beauty.
You can almost just take one stanza of the song and try to haiku that as opposed to tackling the whole thing.
Absolutely. And, the other one that I'll just throw in there, and I won't get into it as much, there's a song called Angelina, which was written around the same time, I think. It was recorded for the album Shot of Love in 81, but then left off, and that was put out on the bootleg series later.
Mm-hmm.
Angelina was, I just said Bob discovers that converting Angelina isn't that easy. And, I discovered writing the haiku wasn't that easy. I mean, he has these lines about black Mercedes in a war zone, and your servants are half dead and you're out of luck. You know, he's asking tall men where they want to be conquered, perhaps Jerusalem, perhaps Argentina. And then, you know, a line like, beat a path of retreat, up them spiral staircases, past the tree of smoke, past the angel with four faces, begging God for mercy and weeping in unholy places.
Mm. Yeah, good luck with that.
Tarot deck of confusion.
Right. That's almost a good haiku right there.
That's right.
Fantastic. I love the concept. Love the execution. Shall we have a beer?
I think we should have a beer.
Okay. This is what we're having today. We're going to do two, as always. We're going to do the Green Port Harbor Tidal Lager from the east end of Long Island. And we're going to do the Two Roads Road to Ruin IPA from up the highway a bit into Connecticut. That's a double IPA. Which one you want to do first?
Let's start with the G, the green.
Greenport Harbor Tidal Lager.
After, because I've always thought, I think Long Island and liquor, I think wine on the North Fork, right?
Yeah.
Some of which, of course, are very good.
Yeah.
So I haven't had a beer from Long Island before.
Okay, it's out that way. It's Greenport is where you take the ferry to Shelter Island.
Oh, yes.
And a nice little cluster of bars and restaurants.
We spend a lot of time. Our family has a place in Martha's Vineyard, and so oftentimes in the summer I try to fly up on the JetBlue, and you always see a beautiful view of Long Island when you're flying up there.
Absolutely.
So I'm ready to taste a bit of it as well.
All right, well, let's do it. The Greenport Harbor Tidal Lager. It's a 4.7% alcohol
Cheers.
Beer, relatively light. Let's see how it tastes.
Maybe it's me.
Okay.
And I'm going into this cold because I'm not a beer descriptor man. I don't know my beer words
or okay.
nomenclature, I should say, as the experts would call it. But maybe because there's green in the name, I almost feel like I can taste green grass when I drink this.
Okay. There is a vegetal feel to it. Sure.
Almost citrusy, is that a word they use in the world of beer?
It is. I think the next one, the Two Roads, will be very citrusy. Based on that big hoppy character of it. But yeah, this is a European-style pale lager. They describe a copper hue. It does have a little more copper in it than a typical lager, I would say.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's copper before it's oxidized or whatever happens to it.
Right. Pilsner malts and noble hops make this a crisp and seasonal... sessional... Sessional. Okay.
I like that word.
I've seen sessionable before. I assume it means the same thing, but it just means something you could sort of have a lot of, you know, something that's not going to overwhelm you with major alcohol.
Session beer.
Sessionable. Yes. I think the proper made-up adjective is sessionable. But
this is the kind of beer I could see. this is you just mowed the lawn.
Yeah.
And you've worked on the car. And maybe you filled up the tires and it's a hot day kind of beer, and you're going to sit under the umbrella on the patio.
Yeah, the fact that you've earned the beer, maybe you want something more than a standard butter course or something like that. So, and you know, as you said with the Greenport setting, you know, maybe something beachside.
Evocative in the name.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, a tasty lager, not the kind of beer I usually drink, and lager is kind of the stepchild to the whole craft beer movement. You know, everybody's doing the big monster IPAs.
Why is that? Is it because everybody wants to go for kind of the extreme part of the taste spectrum?
That's a big part of it. The IPA just became kind of the poster boy for craft beer, and I think for a lot of the smaller shops, the lagers take a long time to brew, and it just becomes kind of an operational thing. Maybe you don't have that much time to... fill up your fermenters.
But of course, the lager, and I don't know my beers very well, but if I think back to Germany and the Reinheitsgebot of 15 whatever, almost as important as Martin Luther's theses was the Reinheitsgebot, setting the rules for and ingredients for proper beer production.
Okay.
Wasn't the lager sort of the humble mainstay beer of the German
That sounds right.
German people? I don't know.
I don't know either, but that sounds...
Mr. Encyclopedia Brown working hard here.
There you go.
Pulling out whatever I can remember from years ago.
Hey, could you describe this beer in a haiku? On the spot? Is that unfair? He's thinking.
Copper, wholesome brew fills my belly and my heart. Perhaps two would do.
With a rhyme. You got a rhyme in there on the fly.
I have to say one thing that we didn't discuss, and I only touched on very briefly, and I have to qualify this in case there's a real haiku expert listening.
Okay.
Number one, I'm not a haiku expert. Number two, traditional haiku coming out of Japan specified a few things that I choose to ignore.
Okay.
About how you have to do it. Typically, a haiku is going to put at least one metaphor into its structure.
Okay.
Second, it typically is going to be a metaphor that has to do with nature and seasons. And third, that haiku also is going to use nature and seasons or observations of things happening in nature to describe not just the thing that's in front of it, but the changing nature of the heart or emotions. And, you know, so it's not just 17 syllables arranged in three lines of 5, 7, and 5. It's actually trying to, it's trying to evoke a particular mood and feeling that uses, you know, the weather and all sorts of other kinds of seasonal phenomena.
Okay.
To make its point. They traditionally also tend to reach a climax somewhere near, but not quite at the middle.
Okay.
With what the Japanese would call a cutting word, and then to resume in the second half and in a slightly asymmetrical form. Come on, it's too hard.
It's like three acts in a haiku.
I think the more fun thing to do is the acrobatics of actually trying to get it into the syllabus.
Sure, sure.
But I just wanted to point that out in case anybody ever writes to you and says, you know, I heard that Macmillan on your show, and that's not haiku what he's doing.
They would write, too. They wouldn't email. I think they would send a proper
letter. They would send a letter.
Okay. So did you read a lot of haiku to sort of get in the mood for this thing?
I did not.
You didn't?
I confess.
Okay.
My haiku guiding spirit is another person who... a very famous writer, no longer with us, who in many of his unpublished, and I think some published work, wrote something like 900 haiku about various things, and that was the African-American author Richard Wright.
Oh, wow, I didn't know
that. Richard Wright, you know, he did all his, you know, Native Son and all these other famous works, but he also, for, I guess, his own amusement, wrote, I think it might have been 847 haiku in his life, I don't remember the exact number, but he wrote these... you know, he wrote these on a variety of topics, and again, was, you know, has been assailed by some purists as not being a real haiku writer.
Mm.
But he wrote about, he wrote funny, interesting, you know, he wrote a haiku about normal topics. And, you know, one of them is called, see if I can find it here. I mean, you know, here he's using ones that actually fit the bill. You know, I am nobody. A red sinking autumn sun took my name away.
Okay.
Or, with a twitching nose, a dog reads a telegram on a wet tree trunk.
Hmm.
I mean, he was full of these, and they were very prosaic in many ways, but of course, as the best haiku are, they hint at profound depths.
Yeah, sure. I would think with the publication of your book, you must have been the most prolific haiku writer in America last year, no?
I have a feeling that I might have been
okay.
At least the most prolific published haiku writer, and I know it
okay.
I know it with some amusement that when I published Haiku 61 Revisited on Amazon, for several weeks it proudly proclaimed number 2 most read in haiku and Asian poetry. And of course I took a picture of that and I sent it to my mother and I said, "Look at how your
Look
son
at me.
Turned out."
Oh, good for you. Good for you. Take the victories where they come.
Mm.
Have you heard from many hardcore Dylan fans about this?
No, I've heard from a small number of hardcore Dylan fans in a number of strange places. There's a fellow named Masato Keto. I don't know how to pronounce his name properly because I don't speak Japanese.
Mm.
I don't know how he found me, but he found me somehow when I was doing a lot of this stuff first online before I committed it to a book.
Yeah.
And he's always been a champion of my work. There's an Efric Smith in, I believe, Paris. I can't remember where Efric is. A number of people and then some people in India, which is where I do a lot of my work. Some people in India discovered the haiku. I don't really know how they discovered it. And in fact, there's a guy named Manoj Mathur, who is a guy in his 80s, and he was some former. I think he was a civil servant. I don't remember what he did. But his son and he contacted me and said, "Well, you know, Dr. Mathur is putting out a book of his own haiku collected over a life. Would you please write the introduction?"
Oh,
and of course he said,
nice.
He said, "As you are an undisputed master of the form."
Wow.
And of course I wrote back and I said, "I don't know how you found me, but I'm touched.
I will accept your compliments."
You know, so Dylan fans, Dylan fans, I have found, they tend to be, to the extent they've mentioned this book at all, they tend to do it in a very matter-of-fact way.
Yeah.
There's a website called Expecting Rain, for instance, which is like the the monastery of Dylan everything.
Yeah.
You know, huge archive of material, people discussing Dylan every day. And there I got 2 mentions over a period of a couple years, and it was, you know, basically this dude's got a Dylan book he's doing, and then the second one was, this dude's got a Dylan book out. And
okay.
Various people would acknowledge it. And I'm assuming I sold a few copies that way, but I have no idea if I did.
Sure. What do you do to market the book?
So far, nothing. I have gone on Twitter and I've gone on Facebook and I have said basically, take the National Lampoon line. We'll shoot this dog if you don't buy this book.
You know that's not enough.
I know that's not enough. I'm a full-time person in the news business. And since the book has come out, I have been traveling extensively, both personally and for news. Mm-hmm. And in doing that job, I have simply been unable to get the marketing muscle together. Another issue that's going on here, of course, is that marketing costs money.
Yes.
And I don't really have much of a budget for it yet. So I am trying to impress on a number of my public relations friends, for whom I've done the occasional favor over the years, to maybe try to help me out a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm working on a plan. My feeling is that that time is not necessarily of the essence. That if I can make a splash with it somewhere at some point in the next year, I won't complain.
Okay.
But you know, the real achievement for me is that this is the first time I've written a book and held something in my hands that's an actual book with my name on it.
Yeah.
And to see all the words I wrote inside and to actually not be entirely embarrassed by all of them.
Sure.
You know yourself that the first time that happens, there's only one notable first time that most of us go through that's more exciting than this.
Yep.
And this is a, just to see that and to show my friends that I could do it has been an extremely gratifying
thing. Yeah, no, that's good to hear. That's refreshing to hear because people do forget that. And, I always felt like if I dropped this book on my foot, it might actually hurt. And that's kind of a nice feeling to think that you came up with all the words that would actually hurt somebody's foot.
Absolutely. Look, when I finished this thing and I saw an initial word count of 150,000, I thought, how did I do that?
Mm.
Because I never worked on this for more probably than an hour at a time.
Oh, really?
And there were times where I thought, I'll never be done this goddamn thing.
Yeah.
And then I thought, 150,000 words, I need to cut it. Whoever thought I'd get to the point where I have to cut it back?
Right, right.
That's great.
Sure.
Of course, as an editor, I thought, I have to cut it, because that's what editors do.
Of course. But what was your degree of Dylan fanhood going into the project?
Right. So I'm what you would... I don't know if there's a word for what I am when it comes to my music tastes. I would say that I'm all over the map. I don't know rap music very well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know country music very well, particularly modern country music.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly firmly grounded in rock and roll and pop music, as well as a lot of very avant-garde music that a lot of people wouldn't define as music. I have a huge range of tastes where I have bought, as much of a collection as I could by a variety of artists who are nothing like one another. Dylan was one of them. I've always liked him. The voice never bothered me. In fact, I thought it was a main attraction when I first heard him.
Yeah.
I as a kid, my parents had two Dylan albums. They had Greatest Hits, Volume 1, and they had New Morning, which is a kind of forgotten Dylan album.
Huh. But,
Big Lebowski fans will know it because it has The Man in Me on it, which figured prominently in that movie. We played those albums. We used to move around a lot when I was a kid, Washington, D.C. to Washington State, to Pennsylvania to Texas to New Jersey, and we did it in a Porsche 911 and a VW Beetle, my mom in one car, my dad in the other, CB radio.
Oh, wow.
And we played 8-track tapes in the car. We had 8 tracks of Dylan, among other things, Simon and Garfunkel. And this is back at the time when you would hear Dan Fogelberg on the radio a lot, and the Music Box Dancer, Air Supply,
okay,
Barry
a lot
Manilow.
Of Paul McCartney's Wings,
Wings
I think
was
of
on
that era.
Quite a bit, and then Mozart Horn Concerto.
And the Pina Colada song?
Pina Colada
which
song.
Which you referenced
on.
Before?
Ring My Bell, all this stuff was on the radio at the time. But Dylan was part of that palette of musical education for me as a kid. He started to come more to the fore when I was in high school, and I finally actually gave Positively 4th Street a proper listen, and I think it was right after my first big breakup.
Yeah.
And I thought, you take that. And I thought, so this guy's pretty good. When I got to college, though, that's when I roomed with a guy named Tarek Rizk from Pittsburgh, and Tarek and this other friend of mine named Xinling Shen, girl from New Jersey, both of whom remain friends to this day, they had Dylan albums that I'd never heard of that were contemporary to us. I never thought that he was still putting albums out.
Right.
I thought he was a guy from my parents' generation. And here he is putting out these albums like Oh Mercy Under the Red Sky, and I got myself a Rolling Stone subscription, and I started seeing that these are new albums with new reviews, and I thought, I'm going to check this guy out.
Yeah.
And I thought, these albums are way more, they're way more hip, if you will, and contemporary than I ever thought they'd be for some guy who I assumed was an old codger.
Right, right.
And so I thought, well, I should probably start buying these. And the nice part about those Dylan albums at the time is that they were so poorly reviewed most of the time, because he wasn't, you know, he wasn't selling big crowds in big arenas those days.
Right.
He was, his act was really erratic. People didn't like a lot of what he was doing. And you know, he was really fading away. And so a lot of his albums you could buy for a cut rate price. And that's just what I did. I bought the CDs and I bought the vinyl for really cheap prices. And yeah. I built up a Dylan collection really quickly. But I didn't obsess. I just bought them the same way that I bought the Beatles, the same way that I bought all this stuff by, you know, I like Einstürzen and Neubauten, industrial German music, you know, and, you know, Wire, Stevie Wonder, you know, whatever, Joni Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
Leonard Cohen, I just started buying his stuff the same way. It didn't stand out to me.
Yeah.
Even though I knew he was brilliant. It was only when I decided to write the book that I thought, all right, let's get to the bottom of what all this stuff is about.
Sure, sure.
And surprisingly enough, I'm still interested in listening to him now after I think battering the songs to death in the stereo over and over again to try to get at the lyrics.
Yeah, well, he's definitely had a bit of a revival, at least touring-wise, the last, I don't know, 8 or 10 years.
But how, for sure.
How are the new albums? You know, going back to, like, Time Out of Mind, or I don't even know how long that's been, but, you know, looking at the last decade or so.
I think that's, yeah. I think that when, if you want to talk about when the kind of middle Dylan went away and the sort of elder, gruff, statesman of the old man of the mountain we know these days, that probably was after he did those two folk traditional albums, World Gone Wrong and Good As I've Been to You. Mm. Then he came back with Time Out of Mind, where he got the Grammy, I think for Lovesick it might have been, I don't remember which song.
Okay.
And he, you know, he was even raspier than before, and you know, world weary, and but still kind of randy at the same time. Those albums, what do you got? You got Time Out of Mind, Love and Theft, Modern Times, Together Through Life, and Tempest. Those are the ones of mainly, I think, original songs, right? Mm. Plus he did the Christmas album in that
right.
time. He did the two Sinatra albums as well. I find them all to sound pretty different from one another. The lyrics are often very similar in their tone, the sort of world-weary resignation
yeah.
and the kind of eternal, he's eternally wandering and can never rest. You know, and he's heartbroken, but he's, you know, but he's horny, you know. I find them to be, for the most part, wonderful albums. I mean, but you would expect me to say that. I think they have their weak points. I think they drag a bit here and there. But there's times when he just, when he's committed, they've always said this about Dylan, when he's committed, he delivers it. And he still has that way of delivering a vocal that nobody else, I think, has
yeah,
ever had.
Sure.
And in particular, regarding recent albums, you know, everybody loves to get pissed off about the latest thing Dylan's done. He's got a way of, you know, encouraging, or not encouraging, but people just seem to, sometimes people just don't like him. The Sinatra albums, I think, did that to people. What's he doing the Sinatra stuff?
Right, right.
Ah, you know, come on. He loves the material, and you can tell he loves the material. He pays attention to his vocal nuances. His band is on fire,
mm-hmm.
When I say on fire, I mean in a very mellow way.
Right.
But they are they're bringing it home.
Yeah.
In just the way that they should, and he respects the songs while totally remaking them.
Hmm. Could this format, could the book work for the Beatles, for the Stones, for another artist?
Boy, I had hoped to think that yes, because then, you know, we could have a fun Robert Macmillan Presents series.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, I think if there's a way through, though, I haven't found it yet.
Okay.
Dylan, there's something special about Dylan, about his songs, whether he's doing a ballad or whether he's doing a kiss-off or whether he's doing some nonsense from the basement tapes. There's something summarizable about his work. The Beatles, you know, I'm sitting here and thinking to myself, I mean, how do I feel like they'd have to be even straighter somehow. Like, they'd have to be just news headline type of haiku.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the way to do it is to do a limerick. We could do limericks for the Beatles, right? There once was a man from Strawberry Fields, you know?
Oh my goodness.
Right? Wow. I mean, I would probably have to keep it pretty dirty, too. It would probably be not suitable for work.
Right,
but,
right.
But the Beatles, like, how do you
good
do
challenge.
I mean, how do you do Hello, Goodbye? Yeah. You know, it's, or Obladi, not that one. What's the one I was, it can be, Wild Honey Pie,
mm-hmm.
Revolution Number 9. I mean, I'm picking on the White Album here, but.
Right, right.
I don't know. I don't know if I have it in me to do the Beatles.
Okay. All right. You have it in you to try another beer?
I always.
Okay, good. I like that. Okay, like I said before, the Two Roads Road to Ruin Double IPA. It's a big hoppy beer. Plenty of bite. Our assertive hop-centric Double IPA has a lean malt backdrop and is brewed with four American hop varieties. If you're scoring at home, it is the Summit, the Palisade, the Cascade, and the Magnum hops. Let's give this thing a taste here.
All right.
Cheers.
Ready to hop away. Now, this is more my kind of beer.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
I like the first one.
Yeah.
But this one has this kind of, this ball of malty something that just got right behind my nose.
Mm-hmm.
And almost like a thistle, and I don't mean in a harsh way. I mean like in a sort of puffy way. It's more smoky.
Yep.
I think, and it's a beer that matches the temperature of this room, and is a beer that matches the fact that there's kind of a cold wind blowing off the river today, right down the street.
Okay. Yet a bit of sunburst as well after a long gray season. So,
absolutely.
Maybe that's the kind of the floral notes in it a bit.
Yes. There's almost a rosy, almost a rose watery kind of finish there now that you're mentioning it.
Yeah, there's a lot of flavor going on here. A bit of pine and definitely some citrus and kind of everything you'd want out of your double IPA. I mean, as the name suggests, the double IPA is kind of the IPA plus one. Or...
Well, they say that Connecticut's a place that most people enter so that they can drive through it to get somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But I would say this one's worth stopping for.
Yeah, I haven't been to the brewery. I don't know offhand what town it's in, but they come up with great names for their beers. They've always, you know, as a fan of the puns, Two Roads always comes through with clever names. But another really, really tasty brew from them.
I noticed here in this restaurant when we came in here that there was a, and I don't know if they have it here. Oh yeah, I was almost intimidated by this French beer. I'm assuming it's from Quebec or New Brunswick. The Unibro à tout le monde, because on the board outside on the front, it said Unibro à tout le monde Megadeth. Which I actually thought was the name. I thought that was the name of the beer. Then I realized that maybe it's just simply the heavy metal pairing that you're supposed to have with the beer.
Oh, wow. So telling you what to listen to while consuming?
And I'm thinking, what's the name of a beer doing in French with the word Megadeth attached to it?
Which
evoked all sorts of other possibilities of poetry as well.
Okay.
But this is a fine
beer. Explains it here. It's from Canada. It says, born of the friendship between its brewmaster, Jerry Weitz, and Dave Mustaine, the legendary lead vocalist and founder of heavy metal group Megadeth.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Start the day with a Montreal bagel and end it with the Megadeth beer.
Right, right, right. It really can't say enough about the beer menu here at the Oath. They've got 20 selections and a mix of local, such as Peekskill Paramount Pale Ale and Captain Lawrence's Effortless Grapefruit IPA, and brews from all over the map here, including the Unibrow and Bear Republic and just all sorts of good stuff here. The Kona Cocoa Brown Ale from Hawaii.
It looks fantastic, and of course this is my first time here, and I can say after having eaten here as well that I'd recommend that others come.
Yeah, no, they're nice to us. It is the Oath, O-A-T-H, the Oath in Tarrytown, New York. Nice view of the Tappan Zee Bridge and the Hudson. So we're going to do the speed round here.
Oh, yeah. I tried to prepare for this, but I don't know. I'm going to... All right. Let's put it in fifth gear.
There is no preparing for the speed round here. Best Dylan album?
John Wesley Harding.
Huh. Okay. Worst Dylan album?
No such thing. Real quick, people like to say that the Dylan 1973 album, which Columbia put out without his permission, is his worst album. I think there's things to love in there. I think if there had to be a worst Dylan album, it's got to be, God forgive me, Knocked Out Loaded. It's just not a great album.
Okay.
Great moments, not a great album.
Jacob Dylan is...
He's that dude whose music I haven't listened to yet, but I swear one of these days I'm going to hear him beyond just a couple of music videos from MTV back when I was in college.
Okay. Favorite New York City bar?
It doesn't exist anymore. The one that was my favorite was Bar 41 on 41st and 7th, and it was the place where we went to go to get hammered cheap quick, usually while still on deadline.
Okay.
And it always came out of there smelling like the fry machine.
Right.
And it was disgusting, but we used to go there all the time because they used to give us gin and tonics was an afterthought. But as far as current bars, I'm not going to say best bar in New York. I'm going to say bar that we go to the most because they are insanely kind to us because of our business. There's a restaurant there called Café Un, Deux, Trois on 44th Street. It's where all the old ladies go before they go to the theater.
Yeah.
44th Street between
5th and 6th, is it? 6th
between
and
Broadway.
6th and Broadway.
It's between 7th Broadway and then 6th.
Okay.
And we go there because... Again, the staff there are very nice to us, and they always find a table for us, and they give us the drinks we want, and they're very kind. And we often run into Alec Baldwin over there too. I don't know why. I guess because he might be acting in some show.
Mm-hmm.
Deborah Messing's there a fair amount, and we usually just ignore the stars and drink our drinks.
Nice. If I could have just one beer for the rest of my life,
I would take. Oh boy. One beer for the rest of my life. I suppose I know which beer I'd have. A little town in Germany.
Okay.
Where I spent a lot of my time growing up. And nearby there was a town called Haigerloch. And there is a Haigerlocher Pilsner. And that beer was the beer of my teenage years.
Hmm.
Drinking Haigerlocher Pilsner. Until the stars started rotating.
Okay.
And I don't know if you can get it outside the area or not, but anybody who goes to the area around Stuttgart, go find yourself a Haigerlocher Pilsner.
Okay.
And drink that. Here in America, I don't know any obscure brands, but I'm a big fan of, and always have been, of Anchor Steam.
Can't go wrong.
And
yep.
I think when you've done a lot of hard work and it's a hot day and you really want something to relax with, nothing beats a Red Stripe.
Okay. All right, a speed round done. What's next for you? You got a new book in the works?
Yes, I am. I'm all in, and I'm 100% committed, but still quite nervous at the same time about trying to do something that I've always told myself I needed to do, which was that before I start doing anything avant-garde in my writing, which maybe the Dylan book aside, I need to write something where I know that I can master the basics of plot, dialogue, movement, description, and a traditional story, basically.
Mm-hmm.
A traditional modern novel.
Okay.
Something that could have been written any time in the past 100 years. Write novels today that we tend to look at in America as being the touchstones for what we consider to be the most enjoyable structure, come from, I guess, John Cheever, John Updike, Margaret Atwood, Saul Bellow, Philip Roth. Alice Munro does more short stories, but I mean, you know the kind of structure I'm talking about.
Yep.
I've never been able to finish a fictional project that I've started that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and doesn't use gimmicks or so-called modernism to try to make its point.
Mm.
And so I'm starting. I had an idea for a book. Plumbing the depths of a town that is very much like the one I grew up in, but is fictional.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few people down there in our school system who I didn't really care for when I was a student. I never understood them. These were kind of jock guys who became teachers, and I didn't think they had a whole lot of sympathy or empathy for the nerdy kids like me.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of made life hell for me, although I'm sure they didn't know that. And I thought, rather than turn them into villains, wouldn't it be interesting to get into make a fictional character and try to get into the psychology of these people and how they and sort of look at how they got to be where they were. And then have something bad happen to them. Not, you know, no gunshots. Isn't it? You know, I don't do guns in my books. I don't want to do that.
Right.
Right. I want to make good drama out of quiet everyday scenes.
Okay.
And I want something to happen to this teacher I've invented, where he's going to discover that all the good things that he thought he's done and all the good person that he thought he was, he finds out from another person that in fact other people have a different impression of him, and he tries to. He tries to right that wrong, and doesn't do it properly, and in fact only reinforces his nature as being somebody who's probably unqualified to teach and unqualified to be around children.
Okay.
So he's a hero you can get along with.
Absolutely. No,
I'm giving him a sympathetic portrayal.
Okay. And how do people get a hold of you? How do they find Haiku 61 Revisit? Amazon, obviously.
Haiku 61 Revisited, I published through CreateSpace, which is a self-publishing platform owned by Amazon.com. The book is available on Amazon, as well as sister Amazon websites in Canada, France, Germany, various European locations, India as well. and it's on Kindle and it's in print. So you can easily find the book that way. You can also always reach out to me on my Facebook page. I am Robert MacMillan. I think my Facebook name is Bobby Mac Reporter.
Okay.
My Twitter name is Bobby Mac Reports. A little bit different.
Okay.
And I'm freely available there as well. And anybody who ever wants to write to me can certainly do so at robert.macmillan@gmail.com. I promise you I will write back.
Okay, good. Well, a huge thank you to Robert MacMillan, author of Haiku 61 Revisited, for making the trip up to Tarrytown and talking about the book and sharing a couple beers with us.
It's been great to be here. I'm so happy that I came up.
Good. Happy to have you. And thank you, dear listener, for listening. This is Mike Malone signing off from Books and Beer. We'll be right back.